Good morning. It's Friday. There's lots going on in the political world. And maybe we'll start with a joke. A genius and a madman walk into a YouTube room. That would be, of course, Jody Barr and Garland Nixon. Let's talk. Garland Nixon here with Jody Barr. Jody, tell everyone before we get going where they can find all your stuff.
Oh, sure. So my website is thecommunists.org. My Telegram channel is Jody Barr, and you can also follow my party there, The Communists. We've got a YouTube channel, Proletarian TV, and we're on Twitter and other places like that.
All right, so let's get started. You know, we've got a number of things going on in the imperialist nation, some serious instability. We had a debate last week where, you know, we could tell a lot of jokes and all these things about it, but here's the reality that I think that was uncovered for those who didn't already know, and that is that Joe Biden, or whoever the president is not in charge. You know, I mean, people can laugh, they can make jokes about all kinds of stuff, they can be afraid, whatever they want to be. But the reality is, what do we learn? Biden comes out there, he babbles, he, you know, gets confused, etc. And the fact of the matter is, they talk about whether or not he should do another term, as opposed to whether or not he should do another minute. Because everybody really deep down intuitively knows the president's not in charge. Macron, the people in France aren't thrilled with him. Certainly Rishi Sunak. It's not the people they're angry at. It's a system that threw them under the bus 40 years ago, and now they're feeling the pain, and it's being sped up. Jody Barr, we go to you. The electoral debacle in the UK, and let's start with the UK since you're there. We'll move on to other stuff, but electoral debacle. But when it comes to it, six in one hand, half dozen in the other. Oh boy, Keir Starmer to the rescue. Jody Barr.
Well, yes, it is very much Keir Starmer to the rescue as far as the ruling class is concerned. I've talked to you before about the fact that he's been their man for a long time. They put him in the Labour Party because they thought he would be a good prime minister, essentially. And he's been kind of groomed, and things have been created, and PR has been created around him. There's been all kinds of massaging going on to make that happen. He's definitely their man. What's really interesting, I think, is how unpopular Labour are. And they're still unpopular, despite the fact that they've seen, you know, so you can spin these headlines many ways, right? You can look at the number of seats Labour won and say, oh my gosh, it's the most enormous landslide victory ever, right? Or nearly ever. But the truth is, it's unprecedented for a government to win so many seats on such a small share of the votes and such a small number of votes, right? So this is a peculiarity of our system. We have this first-past-the-post system, which means in each area of the country, you know, you vote separately, and, you know, whoever wins in that constituency is the MP, right? And because that's first-past-the-post in each place separately, you can come second across the country and not have a single MP. You could have a huge share of the votes. And in fact, that's what we're seeing. This time around, the percentage of votes for Labour and Tory combined is the lowest it's ever been. It's just 57.5%. So again, those are the two main parties. And of the votes cast, and we'll talk a minute about votes cast, right? Of the votes cast, Tory and Labour between them got 57.5%, right? And, you know, let's talk a little bit just about the faith in the electoral system. You know, there's such a crisis here now. A whole load of people don't even register to vote. So I was looking this up because nobody reports on this, right? The number of adults in the UK who are over 18 is 53,600,000. The number of adults who are registered to vote is 48,800,000, right? So that's a gap, of 6 million. So the 6 million people who could be on the electoral roll who aren't, so they've just given up, there's no point even registering. And then of those 48.8 million people who were on the rolls, only 29.1 of them turned out to vote. That's less than 60% of the registered electorate. So the total number of British adults who voted for this landslide Labour win is 18%, less than 10 million people, right? And it's amazing to have a system that can be so manipulated that less than 10 million votes out of an adult population of 53.6 million can give you a huge majority in Parliament, right? That's what they've achieved, the British ruling class. And they did a couple of things, well, quite a few things to make sure they got that result, despite the fact that all the mainstream leaders are unpopular and all the mainstream parties are unpopular, to make sure they got us, they really wanted a stable government, because the next period is going to see really relentless attacks on the working class. It's going to see more war. It's going to see a beating on the trade unions. And they want a Labour government to front that up. Because when a Labour government fronts up war and fronts up attacks on the working class, it has the trade union leadership in its back pocket. And they advise the working class not to do anything, because if you rock the boat, you'll get the Tories back in. So Labour is the alternative party of power for the ruling class when the Tories have become so unpopular they need an alternative. And it has this added bonus of putting them in a position to really beat on the working class with very little opposition because of this historic bond. I mean, it's a shackle, you know, on the trade union, organised trade union movement, that their connection to the Labour Party means they basically do as they're told by Labour, and Labour does as it's told by the ruling class. It's a fantastic system if you're the capitalists in charge, right? So I think that's really important to understand. The absolute turnout of all adults in Britain was 54%, right? And in some constituencies, it was down in the low 40s. So people are really turning away from the whole system. There's a real crisis of confidence in that whole thing. You know, the Tories' share of the vote is the lowest they've, or no, their share of seats is the lowest since like 1832. The combined national vote for Labour and Tory is lower than since World War One, right? All the leaders are unpopular. And Starmer's landslide this time was achieved with fewer votes than Corbyn got when he was wiped out in 2019, right? So, you know, all these things make it quite clear, don't they? They paint a very different picture than you might imagine from some of the headlines. And it's a big enough worry for the ruling class that they are talking about it, actually, or some elements of this they are talking about in their analyses. So there's a big, oh, all right, big party for Labour. We win, brilliant. But there's the discussion about what the problems are starts quite early in the serious newspapers, you know, the kind of four paragraphs in, they're into, but there's a bit of a problem, isn't there? And, you know, the fact that they've got so many more seats than the Tories, but only 10% more of the votes, that's also, it starts to make the system look very dodgy, right? And then you have something like Reform UK, which is the kind of anti-immigrant party, basically. It's just kind of one policy. Well, it's got two policies. One is anti-immigration. The other one is proportional representation. Reform the system so that you can, you know, people's votes count, right? And of course, they would say that, wouldn't they? They're in that situation where they got, I think, 14% of the vote and four seats. Well, it's the first time they've had any seats. Some years back, when they were in a different iteration as the UK Independence Party, they got 11%, I think, of the vote. I'm going from memory here, so apologies if I'm getting that wrong. And no seats, right? So this is the first time that a party headed by Nigel Farage has had any seats. They got four. And actually, the fact that Nigel Farage came back is the only reason that they did so well. They picked up a lot of the anti-Tory, anti-Labour, angry working class vote. And he was lent on really hard to come back into politics. He didn't want to. So Reform is his party, but he's sat on the sidelines. He's not been a candidate. He's not been the leader. Someone else is the leader, but that guy's not really, Michael Tice, I think his name is, he's not really kind of getting any traction with the public, particularly. And the reform vote was hovering around 1-2% in all the elections for a long time. And basically, the ruling class wanted to make sure the Tories got their kicking and Labour got a landslide. They wanted to make sure of that, and they lent on Farage to make sure that reform would take a whole load of angry Tory votes, right? Angry working class votes. On top of that, they called the election early because they wanted to make sure that the anti-Labour, anti-genocide, anti-war vote, which was this big head of steam building up behind the demand for independent, anti-genocide, anti-war candidates, anti-Labour candidates, big demand for it growing and a head of steam behind those campaigns getting established, they wanted to cut that short. And I'm sure that was another one of it. It was a big reason they called the election early. It's a big reason that they leaned on Farage to come in and make sure the Tories really got beat, you know, because they know Labour's not popular. So it wasn't so much that Labour won, it's that the conditions were created for everybody else, you know, to lose. And that's, I think, really what you're seeing here. And what's interesting about this is you would normally expect a government coming in with such a huge majority to be stable for a long period of time. But what's clear about this big majority is it's on very shaky ground. There's no guarantee that Keir Starmer gets a second term. He could get a wipeout in the next election in terms of, you know, seats and all the rest of it. I think that the crisis actually is deepening, and the ruling class has pulled all the tricks it can, you know, to make sure Labour got this result. But it's not on a sure footing at all.
Well, oh, one second. My light is blinding. Let me turn out one of my lights. You know, what I'd like you to comment on also, and this is important. This is not a UK phenomenon.
No.
Look what just happened in France. Macron came out and called I don't think it was an accident. He calls an early vote also. And then, you know, you've got what they consider, oh, a big deal here. But what happens is, you know, the Le Pen people kind of say, well, you know, when it comes to foreign policy, even if we get power, we ain't going to make that much change. We just kind of roll with the punches. Meanwhile, over here, we have a debate. Biden did what Biden, everyone, you know, who had been paying attention knew he was going to do. He's not, you know, capable right now to really hold office. But he is. He is capable. He's not capable to hold office in the context that he is actually making decisions and control of it, of anything. But apparently the ruling elite are like, yeah, well, they could have a cardboard cutout of Joe Biden and they'd be just as happy as long as the people would accept that there was an avatar there for power, right? So you look at the US and then what's going on here? Trump's moving ahead. Here's what's interesting. The Republican Party, the rank and file of Republicans love Trump, not because he's a Republican, but because he's different than their, you know, they see him, the Republicans here, see Trump, they hate the establishment Republicans, right? And they see him as something outside of the established Republicans. They love him because not that he is something different. Well, he is in a way, but because they see him. So here's my point. Germany, France, UK, it's the same thing. People don't want reform. They want revolutionary change. They want a complete different direction. And the ruling class is struggling and playing with the rules of when they can call an election and who gets to do what and who's in charge to try to stop this environment where people want, you know, significant, we can say, dare I say, revolutionary change. That's where we are, where the ruling elite are saying, man, people went a complete different direction. They're taking a beating and we'll give them, you know, Keir Starmer versus Sunak and pretend that they got an option. Where do you go from there? Where do you go when the people say, doggone it, I've had enough. I want something different. And you hand them Keir Starmer or you hand them the Republicans or you hand them the Greens versus the Christian Democrats versus the whoever. And then they put in a new bunch. And they get the same thing again, then you're in a real heck of a mess. At any rate, your thoughts on all of that stuff, Jody?
So I think that the ruling class is well aware that there is a crisis of legitimacy and rising tide of anger amongst the working people. You know, we are in the worst ever crisis, economic crisis of this system. And the effects on ordinary people have been being felt steadily since the 60s, right? The deindustrialization, it's called, you know, the speeding up of the export of capital, the end of the post-war boom, construction boom, the end of full employment and good conditions for all workers and all of that sort of thing in the West I'm talking about. So, you know, this has been a kind of steady decline. Then, you know, there was that big shot in the arm for the system with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc of socialist countries in Europe. But it did not benefit all. It wasn't a tide that lifted everybody in the West. It was a tide that kind of exacerbated the difference. It brought some people into the labor aristocracy and lifted them up on the backs of, you know, the money that was flowing in, fed bribes for some sections of the working class, but others whose industrial jobs had gone got nothing from that process and were just expected to keep, you know, shut up and put up with the steady decline in their lives. This process then was massively accelerated from 2008 after the banking crash. Massively accelerated. And we've been living in that world since 2008, where a kind of steady and slow decline has turned into a sharp and fast decline. And then, of course, we had COVID. And then we had, I mean, obviously there was Brexit and Trump before that, but, you know, COVID in terms of, you know, the kicking it gave to working people and their conditions. And then the Ukraine war and the energy crisis and the cost of living crisis, you know, the inflation crisis, inflation just spiraling out of control because the imperialists have been money printing like crazy since 2008. And then they went on steroids with the money printing for COVID, for that crash, right? They called it for COVID, but it was actually, there was a stock market crash. And then for the Ukraine war, they've been money printing. So all of that has fueled inflation. That has massively exacerbated the poverty of people who were already really, you know, suffering from decades of decline of their living standards, wages, conditions, everything. So we have this situation, and this economic crisis is only getting worse. And it's accompanied by a massive and ferocious drive to war. So what the working class has to look forward to, no matter who's in number 10 Downing Street or who's in the White House, is more war, more austerity, fewer jobs, worse pay, worse conditions, fewer services, you know, deteriorating education and healthcare systems, et cetera, et cetera. Everything, just as they say over here, going to hell in a handcart, right? And there's almost nobody in Britain who you speak to who won't agree with the proposition that everything is broken and we need to rip it up and start again. What people are not clear about is what ripping it up and starting again looks like, what it means, and what they can do. You know, the total decimation of real socialist leadership for the working class has left them now that they're in real big trouble, not quite knowing what they're supposed to do about it and not feeling like they have any power really to do anything. That's why so many people don't vote at all. They've totally given up on the whole system. They know it doesn't affect them. It doesn't have any impact, doesn't change anything about their lives to vote for Tory or Labour or Lib Dem or Green or anybody. But into that anger, and to help to stop those people coming to a realisation, number one, that they're a class and they have a collective power if they organise to use it, and that there's an alternative for them that's outside of the system, in come the right-wing demagogues. And what you see all over Europe is the way the demagogue trick works is you do a lot of anti-war rhetoric, which plays very well with the people because the wars are not popular, right? And on top of that, you do a lot of anti-immigration rhetoric. And the anti-immigration is the classic capitalist trick of scapegoating one section of the working class, right? And then all the other parties say, oh, we have to move towards those policies to stop fascism. We have to be more fascistic is essentially the kind of, you know, logic that they all use. Oh, well, it's it's not our fault, but people are voting more right wing. So if we don't want the right wing to be in government, well, we better just be more right wing ourselves. So it's kind of like a little double act that they play. But essentially, they normalize the scapegoating of a large section of the population. And the blaming of, we've talked about this before, haven't we? The blaming of the poorest and the most deprived and the worst victims, the most beat upon victims of this imperialist system. They blame them. And you see that starts to become a soft option, even for those on the left. You know, you start to see people. Now, again, we've talked about this before. I think that people on the left start to say, rather than fighting what seems like an unstoppable tide of anti-immigrant sentiment, they try to find a non-racist way of going and agreeing with those people, right? This is classic populism. Rather than explaining to people how they're being lied to and what purpose the lie serves, you say, well, but we need to be big. So we'll just tell the people what they think they know and we'll just agree with them. So you go along and say, oh, yes, well, we don't like mass immigration either. And you've come up with some stupid phrase for it. We don't. What did I hear someone say recently? We're opposed to the system of mass migration. What are you talking about, a system? The system we live under is imperialism. And one of the effects it creates is mass migration because of the economic oppression and because of the war. Right. If you're opposed to that, then say so. But when you say I'm opposed to the system of mass migration, you're basically agreeing that the problem is the immigrants, not the system.
If I may, let me throw something at you, because this is just my thoughts on immigration, right? Okay. Is it legitimate if you say, well, our borders are being flooded with people and that's kind of destabilizing, right? I would say that's not an illegitimate argument. Certainly, you need some level of border security. Okay, here's my issue, and this is the way I put it, and I think it's a little too complicated of a conversation for a lot of people. You know, they win with sound bites. There's too many immigrants. They're taking your jobs. People are like, yeah. You can make an argument of dilution of labor. You can make an argument of, you know, 20 million people coming in is going to be destabilizing at one time. You can have that discussion. It's not an unreasonable discussion to have in a intellectual context. However, here's the way I try to make the argument. I can't argue with you about the effects of immigration. That's one thing. We destabilize entire regions. We overthrow the government in Guatemala, El Salvador. Right now, we're increasing the sanctions on Nicaragua, on Venezuela, in Haiti. We destabilize Haiti, and then we look, and the border is loaded with Haitians and Venezuelans and Nicaraguans and El Salvadorans and Guatemalans. So you say that you're going to support whatever we're doing to bring democracy, or whatever we're the imperialists, the lies they tell you to destabilize these countries. Yet you're upset with the fact that these people are coming here. We steal their resources, they bring them here, they follow their resources back here, they follow their money back here. You know what I mean? So it's a little bit complicated to say it is a legitimate discussion to say whether 20 million people crossing your border can be destabilizing and dilute the labor pool. Legitimate discussion, right? Certainly. And they have to have service and things like that. That's not an illegitimate discussion, not in the context of whether the people are good or bad or whatever, but at a time when a country is economically suffering. However, you're going to support the policy. You have to get to how this happened. I have a headache. Well, you can take aspirin, or you get a CAT scan and find out there's a tumor that needs to be removed. You know, and that's the discussion that I have to have. It's a little difficult, but it's, to me, you have to get to the root of the problem, because you're never going to fix it. And instead, you're just mad at the immigrants, not mad at the people who destabilized entire regions of the world. When they overthrew Libya, the people started pouring through Africa. You impoverished Africa after centuries of imperialism. Again, destabilized all of Africa. Anyway, your thoughts on my attempt to get to the foundation of the problem, while recognizing that 20 million people coming across the border is destabilizing, but that ain't the issue. Anyway, your thoughts.
I think that's totally right, Garland. You know, it's not just the imperialist countries that face destabilizing, so they say. And personally, I think the number of immigrants that come to Britain is not destabilizing at all, quite the reverse. Okay, so that's one. That's just one thing to say, right? But even if the number was destabilizing, you know, that is happening all over the world. It's not just in the rich countries. It's happening. There are more, you know, immigrants inside the refugees inside the Middle East, right? Where do you think, you know, Palestinians who've been kicked out of Palestine at various times are living as refugees all over the Middle East and exploited as cheap labor? Syrians, there's been essentially, well, you heard, who have I heard talking recently? Anyway, maybe on one of your shows, but I heard someone talking very eloquently about essentially what was a genocide of Syrian people during the, and you know, genocide is not just killing them. It's the massive dispersal of their population and especially their young people. The Syria's young population has been kicked out of Syria because of the war, and they're being exploited all over the Middle East and Germany as cheap labor. You know, and of course, that destabilizes working conditions for people in those countries too, right? Wherever there are people who are desperate for a crust, they will bring down the wages for everybody in that place, unless the workers everywhere take the same approach, which is we unite with these people, we bring them into our trade unions, and we fight the system that creates this problem. You know, that there is no other way of tackling this that actually works. Everything else, no matter how you dress it up and what kind of left sounding gloss you put on it, essentially, it lands with you identifying with your own ruling class, failing to identify the crimes they've committed abroad, and demanding that the people who are oppressing you and the immigrants should protect you from the immigrants with border controls, right? Border controls that won't work, because when people are that desperate, they'll find a way, okay? And anyway, what we see is the border controls aren't even aiming to work, right? Number one, they can't work, right? It doesn't work. Border controls have never worked. All they do is criminalize people, make them more desperate, make them more exploitable, which all works for the capitalists, and they set sections of the population against one another, which works for the capitalists, because they have to play very hard at divide and rule to stay on top when their rule is actually so shaky and their absolute numbers are so small.
You know, when you said that, that just dawned something. Made me think about a discussion that we had in the past, where basically what we're talking about is petitioning the people who create a problem, the ruling elite. They create, they destabilize, they start wars, they destabilize, they create what you can call a border crisis, however you choose to. Here, we got a lot of high numbers, right? But then you're going to go to them and ask them to fix it. The futility of going to the ruling class, kind of like the whole what we call the woke stuff here, where, you know, they say, oh, there's racism and sexism and all the isms, right? And then they say, we're going to fix it by making sure that every chewing gum advertisement has one black person, one white person, one gay person, one Muslim person. So they're going to fix the issue of whatever ism it is by like making an advertisement symbolically. They've got various groups in an advertisement. So it gets back to the issue of petitioning those who create the problem to fix the problem, and they can just stretch it out with a new fake plan to, you know, resolve it. Let me ask you this, getting back to the crisis and political destabilization in the imperialist nations. NATO meeting coming up next week. And look at the ragtag hodgepodge of losers coming. You've got Schultz, who's got, you know, he's in single digits almost in approval rating. Macron, he's out the window. Sunak, well, I guess he won't be there. He's resigned. You know what I mean? Biden, he may be there, but he'll have no clue he was there. He won't remember it. And God, let's forbid they don't ask him to speak, which I'm sure is not going to happen. Looking at this NATO meeting next week, they're coming together. Putin's sitting over there with an 87% approval rating. 90-some percent of the people in, you know, the evil communist red China, they like their government. And we're bringing a bunch of guys together to say, we've got to stand up against the autocrats and the non-democratic evil guys. And they're all holding onto their seats by the skin of their teeth. This is a comedy here, an evil and desperate comedy coming together in Washington, D.C. next week. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the hypocrisy and doublespeak of the rulers of or the spokespeople of the ruling classes in the Western nations is becoming clearer and clearer for people to see, as is the unrepresentative nature of their so-called representative democracies. You know, this is why, as I said earlier, people in larger and larger numbers are not even registering to vote, never mind turning out to vote, never mind voting for one of the main parties, right? And sometimes where they get the chance to vote for something that they think looks like it will give the status quo a kicking, they go for it. What I think is the problem that I was trying to highlight before when I was talking about how the demagogues work is very often they're sold a pill. They are given what looks like an alternative that isn't really one, to keep them away from the understanding, from understanding in a class conscious way what their problems are and what the solutions would be. But the lack of support for any of these governments is so palpable now. It's so obvious. And that can only get worse, Garland. This crisis has not reached its peak, right? You know, the British ruling class might be heaving a sigh of relief. Oh, thank goodness we got a calm handover from Tory to Labour. There's no hung parliament. We can get our business done smoothly. Whew, thank goodness for that. But it's not as smooth and secure as they would like to present it as. You know, there's all these lectures in the newspapers today about how, I think that Sunak's parting words, he gave a little lecture for the bourgeoisie. Isn't it good that we live in a democracy and we can express our will and we can hand over power smoothly? And I have called Keir Starmer to congratulate him, blah, 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 right? And he gave this little lecture on, you know, how wonderful it is that we do things in such a civilized way in Britain, and there's no upset and there's nothing revolutionary going on. But actually, you know, this apparently smooth handover is hiding, papering over some very serious cracks in the British political system. And its hold over the working class is weaker than I have ever seen it in my lifetime. And I think weaker than it's ever been since World War II, perhaps even since World War I, or the general strike here, which was nearly 100 years ago. And that's only going to get worse because the imperialists don't have a way out. They're getting ready to meet. Their NATO summit in Washington this week is all about how they can accelerate their drive to war, how they can set up NATO in the Far East, how they can extend NATO's reach into Latin America, right? How they can have NATO everywhere and extend their reach and accelerate their war drive, despite the fact that in the theatres in which they're engaged, they are obviously already beaten. Their answer to that is find more men and throw them in and keep it going. Escalate and see if all these men and all these escalations will bring us something that somehow shifts the balance in our favor. Like at this point, that's all they've got, right? But their desire to keep this, or their drive, it's not like some abstract desire. It's a real imperative for the system that if they don't win a huge war and get a whole load of spoils from it, the system's going down. Because the crisis of profitability is very, very real for monopoly finance capital, right? And this drive is pushing them. And it's the people of the world who are suffering and who are going to suffer even more as that drive continues. And there is only one way out, and that is to organize and fight back. decisively. It's not through elections. The elections show us, reveal to us the anger of the people, their desire for change. But what's needed is a leadership that will actually tell the people the truth, which is the change we need isn't going to come through the ballot box. The change we need is going to come through organizing as a class in our own interests against this whole system. And that means organizing side by side in a connected way with all the victims of our imperialist powers' aggression. Right? We have got to be working with the Palestinian resistance, with the socialist countries who are standing up for themselves, with the Chinese, with the Russians, you know, with the people of Syria, the people of Afghanistan, you know, the people everywhere who are targeted, the people of Yemen, everywhere where there are people who are resisting imperialism. We should be working with them, not seeing them as something that we sort of have vague sympathy with, but it's far away, but understanding that our battle is the same battle.
Wow, I agree with you. And the other thing I think is that the big crisis, you know, usually when people want change and they get the appearance of change and there's euphoria, right? There's okay. And this is what the ruling elite is good at. You give them the appearance of change. Hey, we're sticking Obama in. And then there's a certain amount of euphoria, or, you know, whoever it happens to be, Justin Trudeau, whoever, right? Sometimes somebody like Macron comes in and people are like, well, we don't expect change. He's just another banker in a suit, right? But what they're really good at is giving you somebody, they give you the appearance of change. And then there's euphoria, and they ride that euphoria as long as they can and give you the appearance of change. Okay, now they're in a position where they don't have that dynamic, because they can't even provide the appearance of change and they know it. So they're only able to change hands. You know what I mean? Nobody's thinking that they've got something new in Starmer, or that, you know, somehow Trump's going to come in and everything's good. He was already in for 4 years and we got imperialism and all that. So he's a little different flavor of imperialism. That's all, a little different flavor. What happens when people wake up and they've at least tried to say something's different? You know, I mean, to me, there's the bad point for the ruling elite is here, we'll give you something that looks like change. You take it. Darn it, it wasn't change. Here we give you something, you know, we'll give you something that looks like change again. That you take it. Darn it, it wasn't change. Now people lose hope. Now this last round, we give them Keir Starmer. And at that point, or whoever, Trump, whoever, right, Macron, whoever. And at that point, the people now say, it doesn't matter anymore. You can't give us anybody else anymore. You know, the jig is up. The game is over. What happens then? Where are we heading? What goes then? Is that where revolution starts? Is that where people start waking up saying, we have to organize together because these people are just going to play the same games over with us?
Yes. That is exactly where revolution comes from. It comes from a political crisis at the top and a social crisis at the bottom, right? Where the people are no longer willing to be ruled in the old way, and the rulers are no longer able to rule because they're in a crisis also. And we are seeing those conditions developing in countries all over the world right now. You can see the direction of travel is towards exactly that, is towards a revolutionary situation. Now, a revolutionary situation where, you know, you have mass outbreaks of, you know, activity by the masses and turmoil and a rising sentiment and desire and action towards revolutionary change doesn't make revolution by itself. You have to have leadership. You have to have people who actually understand and can help the masses harness their power. You need organization to turn that power, which is otherwise just can just be like a riot. You have to turn it into an army, into a blow that can actually, you know, cause a systemic collapse. But that requires leadership. It requires organization. You know, these are the things which are really lacking in too many countries. There are not enough countries that have strong, scientifically guided, you know, socialist parties, communist parties that can provide that type of a leadership. And in most parts of the world right now, the really strong communist parties are very, very small. Now, this, I don't particularly say, oh, that means we can't win, because in times of political crisis and turmoil, when things are changing very, very fast, when the masses have a need for decent leadership, then those small parties, if they're decent, if they follow the right line, if they tell the truth to the workers and find ways to connect with them, they will grow. And many parties which have been, and even now today, are seem to be very big because they are not able to provide what the workers need, as you've been talking about earlier, they will disappear. You know, we've seen this over and over again in history. Mao Zedong, in his famous comments to a Latin American journalist, and they're printed as an article called U.S. Imperialism is a Paper Tiger, right? And many of us have heard that expression, the paper tiger, right? Meaning that it's not as strong as it looks, right? That underneath the appearance of the tiger, it's made of paper. But he said, you know, that doesn't mean it's not dangerous, but what it does mean is it's not as dangerous as it looks. And further down in the same article, he talks about how small forces that are with the people and with the times grow, and big forces which are not what the people need and not with the times can go to nothing, which includes, of course, imperialism. Imperialism is a phenomenon whose future is in the past, right? It has no real future. It has nothing to offer the people. It has only crisis, only war, only huge and blatant and obscene inequalities, and the massive, massive, massive impoverishment of the world's people and despoliation of the planet. You know, it literally has nothing to offer humanity. So despite the fact that it seems to be this huge behemoth that's, you know, all powerful and all seeing, and we're always being scared by sort of how big brotherish is, big brotherish, I can't speak, the imperialist state machines are, with all their AI and their ability to see everything that you do and read your mind. All of that in the end is not enough to save it from the people when the people decide to move.
Let me ask you about something. I was talking to a person the other day that has the usual, you know, Western brainwash. Capitalism is great no matter what. It's wonderful. It's the best system in the world. And, you know, I was discussing, well, it's not doing well right now, right? But, you know, even you admit that we've got the system's not working. And he was trying to argue that it's been bastardized. It's been taken over by bad people and taken in a bad direction. Reagan and these people and Thatcher, and they took it in a bad direction. And my argument was that's the only direction it could have possibly gone in, because that is, anyway, your thoughts about what, and I've heard people talk about the stages of capitalism, and now describing capitalism as neoliberal capitalism. We got to add something to it because it's really bad. And if you're going to admit that where we are right now in the system is rotten to the core, you can't just say capitalism is bad and this is where it appears. You have to add a caveat. It's neoliberal capitalism, because everybody knows that regular capitalism is wonderful. And my argument to him was, as if regular capitalism doesn't always end up right here, that this is where it goes. This is ultimately I'll end by saying this, and this is the way I put it. If you're arguing that what everybody's supposed to seek their own best ends, we're supposed to make, we're being in a situation where individually we always try to make things at best for us, but then you work for a corporation and the corporation saying all of these employees must subordinate that very thing, and instead they all got to work for what's best for me because I own the corporation, you have a contradiction there. Anyway, your thoughts on all of that, Jody Brar.
Definitely. Well, you know, this classic kind of petty bourgeois hand-wringing over not liking how big capitalism behaves always likes to hark back to a kind of imaginary early capitalism, free trade capitalism, fair capitalism, level playing field capitalism. There was never any such of a thing. I really recommend people to read Capital. I'm in a study group at the moment which is rereading it. You know, I read it a long time ago, and you know, I have the main economic arguments, you know, I have pretty thoroughly, but some of the detail that's in there is absolutely amazing, and I'd forgotten quite a lot of it. So it's wonderful to reread it, and I need to make a note to myself to reread it more often. But it's a massive history lesson. You know, it's not just a kind of dry economic textbook. There's huge amount of detail about the development of bourgeois political economy itself as a science, but also about the development, the genesis of capital. And he particularly looks at England, which is the kind of was the classic case of a nation that developed from feudalism to capitalism. It was the first one that kind of fully finished that development, hence why we had our Industrial Revolution first and the biggest empire and all of that. Those things all go hand in hand, right? The fact that Britain had the first most complete capitalist revolution is the reason Britain had the first biggest, you know, the world's biggest empire, right? Those things are connected, right? It's not an accident. It comes together. Why? So just looking back at the early days of capital, in order for capitalism to come into existence, there had to be a class of people who had the means of production in their hands and a class of people who had no way to make a living except by selling themselves. So what did that mean? That meant that the people who had access to a bit of land that could feed themselves and their families had to be cleared off the land. And that was done. It was done by force. It was brutal. Capitalism, right from the very earliest days, came into the world drenched in blood. Right. And everywhere throughout its history, you have the same story. In order to amass wealth, you have to dispossess a whole load of people. It's not this, you know, this mirage that people have of like, well, I worked hard and I made a fortune. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Other people sweated. And you might have worked as well, but nobody makes a fortune by working on their own. Through their own labors, you can't create enough value by yourself on your own to make a fortune, right? Somebody else's labor was required, was sweated to provide that fortune for you. And they have been impoverished as a result. The labor that they have created, the value they've created through their labor has been appropriated by you to make that fortune. You know, entrepreneurship that we're always taught to kind of worship. Is the desire to become a capitalist, which means the desire to join the exploiting class. That is what getting rich involves. There is no other way, you know, there is no other way. So this is a total mirage that people sell. And then, of course, there's a total misunderstanding of history, what capitalism is, right? We've talked about this before, you know, so I'm sorry to repeat myself and be boring, but capital, you know, has a history. And its history is the accumulation of capital, because the very act of producing for profit means that, which is why this, the only reason that capital does anything is to grow. You employ your capital so that you can make a profit. You do that by expropriating, as I said earlier, the wealth that was produced by the work of others, right? So you employ your capital, it makes a profit for you, right? Now what happens? Now you've got your capital plus a bit more capital to reinvest to make a profit again. So look at that with all the capitals put together over all the time capitalism existed, right? And imagine from small beginnings how huge the concentration of capital has now become. The wealth of the world has been sucked into a handful of enormous, enormous, unimaginably huge piles of wealth, which continue like gravitational bodies to suck more wealth towards them out of the world. And this is an inevitable process. That is why capitalism led to imperialism. So if we've talked about before, Garland, there is no undoing this process. And even if there was a way to kind of cut up all of the capital into little capitals again, all you're doing is asking to go back to the beginning of this process, right? Of dispossessing the poor systematically so that capital can concentrate and grow. That is what capitalism is. There is no way to fix that. There's no way out of it. You can't reform it. You can't legislate for it. You can't. There's nothing you can do to fix the unfairness and inequality and impoverishment of the masses, which is at the heart of production for profit, which is the capitalist system. So, you know, these hopes and wishes and dreams of a nice way to make capitalism sort of be fair somehow or a bit less unfair are really the complaints of a class of former capital owners who are being proletarianized and don't like it. And the only answer really is to embrace your status as a proletarian and say, okay, well, do you know what? The proletariat, the working class, is the class of the future. We are the ruling class in waiting. What we need to do is recognize that fact, organize on that basis, and take our place on the world stage and on the, you know, historical development of humanity.
What are the dynamics that I've noticed in U.S. politics, and I'm sure you'll be able to expand on it, is this the dynamics of, okay, it was in the past, we are doing things that may be tough and you may, they may be a little harsh and et cetera, and they may make things a little tougher for you, but we're doing it on your behalf. You know, we're doing this to fight terrorism. We're doing this to bring jobs back. We're doing this to do good things for you, right? That was the arguments for politics and to get people on board for all kind of imperialist things. Okay, it's different here. And let me kind of explain what it seems like to me. It seems like to me that certain leaders in the ruling class now basically say that leader over there in the ruling class is bad. And my ruling class group doesn't like it. And all you working class people must join on to my team so we can stop Trump or Biden, whatever, right? So it's now become the ruling class saying, let's split the working class up into groups. You know, maybe two, maybe more. Someone else comes along. Hey, join my team because those two working class guys over there, those two ruling class guys over there, they got a team of working class people. So it's now take the working class people and split them up to participate in battles between various factions of the working class. That's a dynamic that I see occurring. You know, Trump, we got to all get on board with me to stop Biden, me and the oligarchs that I represent to stop Biden and the oligarchs that he represent. And I'm like, so the oligarchs are having a fight and they want to split us up to join them for their fights. But who's ever fighting for us? No one. Anyway, your thoughts on that I'm seeing, but I'm sure there's some kind of a historical reference to that with all of the things that you have studied, Jody.
You know, for sure, the ruling class, the capitalists, since they first existed as a class in their pre-revolutionary days, when they were a revolutionary class fighting feudalism, they have always had to mobilize the working class to fight for them. And that was true during revolutionary times. It was true after the establishment of bourgeois republics or bourgeois democracies of various kinds, that when there were fights between different sections of the ruling class, they would, each side would try to mobilize the working class on its behalf, right? And actually during these battles, sometimes the working class made gains because one section of the ruling class, in its desire to beat the other section, would offer inducements to the working class. You know, so for example, the repeal of the Corn Laws or the 10 Hours Bill, which we've talked about again, you know, in the mid 19th century in Britain, both of those measures, which were presented as being, they were both pro-working class measures in different ways, right, or presented as being. But they required the different sections of the ruling class mobilized the working class behind it. So to get the Corn Laws repealed, the Corn Laws were protective tariffs, which enabled the landed section of the British ruling class to have high prices for what they called corn, which is all grains, basically, for grains. Wheat and rye and barley and all of those things, right? Oats. So that meant they had a kind of fixed income and a good income from their farms. There were high prices because the market for grain was protected in Britain, and they didn't have to compete with world market prices. Now, the capitalists in the towns didn't like this, because if the price of bread is high, then wages are high. So they wanted the Corn Laws to be repealed so that there would be cheap food coming in from abroad, which would bring down the price of bread. They mobilized the working class saying, we want your bread to be cheaper. And the working class said, yes, we want our bread to be cheaper. They found out after they got the repeal of the Corn Laws that what happened immediately was their wages fell in line with the price of the new bread. So they got no benefit. it was the capitalists who got the benefit. But the capitalist farmers, who were mostly descended from the old aristocracy, they were really hacked off about this. And in a kind of revenge, they organized for the 10 hours bill, which was the legislation that limited the length of the working day in factories in Britain. And of course, they mobilized the working class, or they joined working class mobilizations for that. What we see is very often in battles between sections of the ruling class, the working class are mobilized to take a side. But in the process, when our rulers are fighting amongst themselves, good things happen for us and our consciousness. Because what you are doing when you mobilize the working class and you tell them things about the other side and their motivations and their behaviors, you are educating them. And you can't put that genie back in the bottle. So the genie that the bourgeoisie let out the bottle right at the beginning of their revolutionary process was, they told the workers that they have a political role in society, that they have a right to look at what their elders, their social superiors are up to, the leaders of their countries. They have a right to look at what they're doing and think critically about it and criticize it, right? Which is absolutely not what feudal vassals were taught to do, right? There's none of your business what goes on in the high court, mate. It's far away from you. But the bourgeois revolutions were fought on this idea of human equality. Now, of course, it turned out not really to be true, but they let that genie out of the bottle and it won't be put back in. So the workers now feel that, okay, we have a say and we're allowed to look at what goes on and think about it for ourselves, right? And then whenever the sections of the ruling class are fighting one another, they will, in their mudslinging, they will let out truths, right? Remember how Donald Trump picked up so much popularity in 2015 or whether he was running the first time by talking about things like the deep state, media lies, forever wars, right? These are true things. They are things that people had started to become aware of, but no one in the status quo ever mentions or admits to. One of the reasons they hate Donald Trump so much is he lets the cat out of the bag about things which the ruling class consensus is, we don't tell the plebs about that, how things really work, right? And Donald Trump, as an outsider, I mean, it's really funny, isn't it, how someone like Trump, who represents quite big capital, but not capital that's quite big enough to put him up at the top table, is this, as an outsider to that total high elite, is seen by poor workers as almost like them. You know, of course, he's not like them. He's never going to fight for working class interests, but he is a disruptor, you know, and that instinct to say, F the status quo is essentially to me what fuels a lot of the kind of Trump mania. And also you see that desperate hope that maybe some of the things we need can come through the ballot box if the person is obstreperous enough. Because again, I just have to come back to this. People are lacking a real strong class conscious leadership. You know, one of the things we need desperately is a communist daily newspaper in every country, right? That can explain to you, that you can look at and read and go, oh, I see, right? There's a different way of looking at all this stuff, but people are not exposed to that. So instead they get conspiracy theories on the internet and they get demagogues who will take a little bit of what is true and wrap it up with a whole load of rubbish and distraction and diversion and scapegoating, and will just confuse you to hell. And so many people who were desperately looking for the truth just, you know, work so hard and can't find it because the voice of, you know, scientific socialism is so small in their countries right now. But I, as I said again, I really believe that in this coming period, with everything that's going on, that voice is going to grow.
You know, last thing, one of the things I recall, and if you could comment on this dynamic, Donald Trump would say something like, they lied us into Iraq, you know, or something like that, right? Something that the working class all knew, whatever it would be, something that, you know, he would say something that was, you know, completely, that goes against the ruling class narrative. And the people in the ruling class would gasp. And then they would all collectively say, that's it for him. You know, he's crossed a red line that can't be crossed. He said that. And all of the working class were like, well, yeah, we all know what that. He just stated something that's glaringly obvious. But when the context of the ruling class, their mouths dropped to the floor collectively. And they were like, it's over for him. So in their class, in their circles, to say that was it. That was, you know, nuclear. It finished. And then they would be shocked when his numbers would go up. And the angrier they would get, as their reaction got angrier, as their reaction got more, you know, they pushed him away. The working class would say, hey, you know, perhaps this guy's okay after all. So your thoughts on the ruling class's inability to grasp even the view of the working class, and to even understand that the working class sees the world differently from them. And then, as I said, when Trump would say whatever, he'd say, you know, like, hey, you know, sure, Syria, what are we there for? To take the oil, of course. And the ruling class would, oh my God, he's got to go. And then his numbers would go up and people would say Trump's telling the truth. At any rate, your thoughts on that, if any?
I mean, definitely, I think there's a whole educative process going on here, isn't there? It's really complicated with people like Trump or even Farage over here, who's often held up as like the equivalent. You know, they're acceptable to the ruling class as the face of demagogic kind of racism, anti-immigrant hysteria, you know, and they whip that up to the highest possible levels. But they do it in a kind of culture wars kind of a way, right? These are both figures who were promoted assiduously by our media machines, right? And Farage in Britain continues to be assiduously promoted. He's a banker, right? Just a racist banker, right? They've promoted him as a man of the people, like they promoted Donald Trump. And for a long time, you know, they loved Trump in the States, and there was loads and loads of promotion of him, endless airtime for the guy, right? That he's something of their own creation. What we have to ask ourselves is, what was it about the situation they were in that made them create such Frankenstein monsters that then sometimes get out of their control? Now, I don't think Farage is particularly out of control. The Brexit result was not under their control. But, you know, he has played their game really all the way along. He bowed out of politics. He let the Tories take all of his votes in the 2019 election so that they could get their landslide and get Brexit done under Boris, not have a continued political crisis that they were having. You know, and then now he's come back in because they asked him to, because they need the Tories to take a bashing, you know. So he kind of does as he's told, as far as I can see, Farage. Trump has got out of their control, it seems to me, but he is totally a product of their making. And they made him because they need to find figureheads to attract working class anger. And the fact they can't even keep control of the puppets they create, I think, is again really telling of the crisis that they are in, and the huge amount of emotion, of anger that's simmering away in the working class looking for outlets. You know, that Donald Trump couldn't just be quietly got rid of after 2020, wasn't it? When he lost to Biden, you know, however you look at that result. But, you know, it wasn't the most resounding election result, considering that he hadn't been the most popular over the last, you know, couple of years. But all of that really just highlights the fact that they can't find leaders who connect with the people. And it's because their system is in so much decay. Every pillar of the system over the last, you know, 30, 40 years has been exposed. We don't trust in your country or mine the judiciary anymore. My God, but that used to be one of the pillars of respectability of our system. And now we don't trust it. We don't trust politicians who used to be deferred to in a really reverential way. We don't trust the media like CNN or BBC that used to be totally deferred to. You know, we don't trust all the people that used to uphold our way of life and make, you know, the mass of people believe that they live in a representative democracy and the civilized world and all this other stuff, right? The course of the crisis, the course of the decay of imperialism has created a situation where it's increasingly hard for the imperialists themselves to govern in a stable way and to find figureheads who are convincing, given all the things we've learned about the system. Because, and you know, to ask the question is to answer it, you know. Why can't this dying, decrepit, crisis-ridden system find good, talented, charismatic representatives? Okay. Just think about the question you asked for a minute, and you're kind of going to answer it, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I saw someone put Trump is not on your side in the comments. And my thoughts on that is, before we go, my thoughts on that is this. One of the things I think they want us to do is argue about personalities. Trump, Biden, what about Kamala Harris? What about this person, that person? And the one thing we can learn from the Biden debate and what's happened afterwards, you know, the Biden debate, what was interesting, that Biden goes out there and, you know, he makes it obvious that he's not, my point, he makes it obvious that he's making no decisions and he's not in charge. He's a conduit. He's an avatar for power. He's a cardboard puppet that they stick up there to distract us, an effigy for us to burn and beat on. So now we can burn and beat this effigy to get to death, and the people behind the scenes can decide how they're going to do it anyway, right? So, but what we learn is that he's not in charge. And we also learned that I forgot where the hell I was going. I got confused. I talked too much. But at any rate, I think it's... Give me a second. I'll get back to it. I'm doing it, pulling a Joe Biden here. Bottom line is that we can't, I had such a good point and I lost it when I started talking about Biden and Trump. But at any rate, I think it all ultimately has to be, it has to do with the concern. Oh, I know what it is. I've got it. Took a few minutes. After the Biden, and this will be the last because I know you got to go. One of the things that I found interesting was after Biden looked really bad, really interesting. When I looked at the response from the ruling elite, it was like this. Oh, my God, what a train wreck. Oh, this is a disaster. This was horrible. This was unthinkable. What he did was terrible. This is the ruling elite. They were straightforward with it, right? But all these poor working class schmucks were on Facebook going, he just had a cold, whatever they could. Well, you know, he stutters a little bit. And I thought, well, this is a weird reversal of fortune where he does really, really bad. And the ruling elite, who are, I guess, concerned about being able to maintain their status and keep a puppet in power, right, are honest. It was terrible. It was horrible. It was unthinkable. It was a train wreck. And the working class followers and hangers on are like, wasn't that bad. It just, perhaps he made a few minor errors, but I don't, and I'm like, what a reversal. Aren't they supposed to be lying? And aren't the people, but I didn't, well, at any rate, your thoughts on that before we go. What a weird dynamic. It's usually they're telling all the lies and working class people are saying, I'm a little suspicious. Anyway, your thoughts.
You know, I think we're witnessing a really rapidly accelerating decay of the formerly strong imperialist countries. And you particularly see this in Britain and the USA. So in the kind of post-Soviet era, we had Blair, you had Clinton and Obama, right? Now, all of those were presented as people of the people, right? People of the, I sound like Tony Blair there, don't I? Oh, person of the person, I'm the person of the people. They were presented as a hope of change, of, you know, representing the aspirations of ordinary people. They were going to fix problems, undo austerity, undo the decline that workers have been suffering for quite a few decades already, as we talked about earlier. And Obama and Blair were good front people, were convincing front people. They knew how to play the game. They looked good in a suit. They could give a good speech. They could do a good hand gesture. You know, Obama particularly very good at looking sincere. I always thought Tony Blair was terrible at looking sincere. I thought he always looked like a cold, you know, hard, dead person behind the eyes, but he did lots of, you know, gestures like that. But when he was first elected, many people were totally convinced by Blair and his persona, right? That he was what he was presented as being. And of course, the course of their premierships exposed the fact that they were not what they had been presented to be, that they were liars. you know, the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, these things showed us incontestably that we were being purposefully lied to by the people in power. So first of all, we get that, right? Oh, these people lie to us. They're doing different things behind closed doors than what they tell us. And they know that they're lying. It's not even that they just made a mistake. They knew they were lying when they lied, right? And we've learned that steadily over the last 20 years. Then this deepening crisis of legitimacy creates a situation where now the ruling class to hang on can't even find the right type of a front person who looks convincing. None of them look convincing. None of them come off like real people. You know, Keir Starmer, Rishi Sunak, you look at them and you're just like, oh, this guy is very hard to listen to, right? There's something not quite right about him, you know, because you kind of feel that he's insincere and he's delivering lines, right? You can feel it, that he's acting on behalf of someone else. With Biden, it's become so crystal clear. And actually, it should have been clear for people with Trump, because he got into the White House, but he was not able to enact the policies he said he wanted to, even some of the ones he gave orders for. And his orders were ignored and overturned, because no, Trump, you can't do that. And other things that he wanted to do, he was told no. And we don't even know the mechanisms they use for some of that, right? But it became clear. It doesn't matter how sincere the person is that you elect and how much they want to do, they will be allowed to do only what suits the ruling class. And the ruling class are not the people that you voted for. The people you voted for are servants of the ruling class. They are front people. They are getting a big fat salary for acting a part and carrying out in public the orders of the people behind them who you don't see. You don't elect them. And there are state machineries which run perfectly well and independently of whoever you elect, right? I mean, we've talked about this before, haven't we? You know, that in Belgium for quite a while, they had no elected government. But I think the crisis went on for maybe a year, right? And the Belgian state carried on making all its decisions and getting on and doing all of its work, right? Because the people who are really in charge are not the people you elect. And that has been becoming clearer to people year on year, election on election, leader on leader for quite some time. But it's really glaringly obvious now. And I think when it comes to the whole Biden debate thing, you know, for me personally, I've said about this before, I find it really distasteful to have to watch Biden, who, you know, he's a war criminal. He's a thoroughly disgusting person all of his life. I can't say I have pity for him, but there's something truly distasteful about the fact that the ruling elite feel that he's a useful puppet and they keep him kind of spinning around and face that way, you know, and he clearly doesn't know what time of day it is. It's kind of nasty to watch. But, you know, the debate obviously, you know, highlighted the fact that he's totally incapable. And so there is a crisis for the ruling elite, how to replace him. They don't have good replacements. As far as I can see, really the only person they've got up their sleeve at this point is Kamala Harris, who, you know, is incredibly unpopular, would be an awful president. She'd be a very bad front person, right? But they don't have anyone else. You know, they don't have anyone else, right? So they're in this kind of like, oh, can we just push Biden through the election and then switch Kamala Harris in? Or do we have to switch Kamala Harris in before? Because actually we don't have anybody like convincing standing in the wings anywhere. So they're in this problem. And I think they're debating quite freely in public about what the hell do we do about this, because it's a real ruling class crisis that they need to, you know, work out. But I think that this phenomenon you're pointing to, if I had to think, well, where does that come from? You know, ordinary workers kind of saying, oh no, he was just having a bad day. I would say this is a symptom of people who are trying really hard to hang on to their blinkers, right? They don't want to let themselves see how badly they've been lied to and manipulated, because they've been telling themselves for so long that all the stories the Democrat Party tells them, that they want, the things the Democrat Party tells them that they want to hear, they've been telling themselves those are true, despite all the evidence to the contrary, for such a long time that it's become a part of their identity, of how they see themselves in the world. And to let that last shred of unreality, let go of that and see the naked truth, is going to be a very, very painful process. Now, I think a lot of those people, they're on the verge of that process happening to them and waking up to reality, you know, and this is their last little bit of trying to cling on.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember a book I read about, it was called The Confidence Game, Why It Works Every Time, about con artists. And one of the dynamics they specifically talked about that was critical that I remember that's very important to the dynamic is after the, you know, how the con artist takes advantage of the fact that you want to feel like you're the smart. People want to feel like they're smart. People want to feel superior. And the con artist butters them up, builds that up, takes advantage of that. And where that's very advantageous to the con artist is at the conclusion of the con. The police knocks on your door, boom, 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 boom. Ms. Brar, we want to tell you that Mr. Nixon that you've recently done a business with, yes, I did a business deal with him for £400,000. He's a con artist. Your money is all stolen. We locked him up. He conned a number of people the same way. Then Miss Brar then has to look in the mirror and she says, no. Now, the police just told you they locked a guy up and he conned 10 people. But you have to then say, no. Like Mr. Nixon's a good guy. He would never. You're really saying, I can't face the fact that I've been had. I am embarrassed. I'm humiliated. I've been taken for a ride. And I have to lie. To me, that's the same thing. You look at Joe Biden and he's like, but befuddled, looks like somebody just hit him in the head with a baseball bat. And when someone says, look at this guy, you say, no, he's fine. He's okay. It's an inability. It's a defense mechanism to say, if I accept that I've been schnookered by these con artists, oh my God, what does that say about me? The whole thing, this whole thing that I've built in my mind as this is the way things works and my party's the good guys and the other, and there are actually two parties and the system is divided, the whole house of cards falls apart. And I think that's kind of where people are getting to, which I might add, I think is a very positive thing, because sometimes people like that, the working class, have to hit rock bottom. You've got to be convinced that you've been conned before you can come out of that mentality. I know we've been on a long time, but if you could comment on that, that's the last one.
I'll just say this, Garland, I think you're absolutely right. And I also think that the mass collapse of that delusion and the anger that's going to come with that is a source of great revolutionary energy.
Viva la revolution, right? Jody Brar, where can everybody find yourself?
We're at thecommunists.org. That's our website. Sign up for news from there. Jody Brar is my name, and it's my Telegram channel also, The Communists. Is our party's Telegram channel. I do recommend Telegram as the best way to follow us. You can also find our content on Proletarian TV of YouTube.
All right, everyone, don't forget. And don't forget, share this on all your social media platforms. Certainly, you know, I'm not on X and Facebook. I'm highly censored. And things like this are going to be censored. You know that everyone who's watching this understands the censorship program that's going on in the U.S. and throughout the West. So it's important. You can be an important part of changing things by sharing this on Telegram, Facebook, Instagram, you know, the TikTok, X, you name it, share it everywhere so other people can at least get an opportunity to hear this conversation and kind of wake up. Whether they agree with it or not, they need to hear it. So as the system falls apart, they'll have some alternative perspectives to at least think about. Thanks a lot, everyone. And I'm sure there are people watching the show right now that are like, oh, that socialism stuff scares me. I don't want to think about it. Maybe that's fine, but at least listen to other perspectives so you can maybe hear something that you like. Thanks a lot, Jody. And I look forward to talking with you again soon. Everybody. We're out.